And we can see whether you're smiling or whether you're not. And so it's this is a treat before it gets too dark. And I agree with Chris, and I appreciate that. What's been really helpful for me is while these steps aren't necessarily separate, they do, one leads into the other, and it has been so important for me, as he said, not to let the inventory or the 8-step list be influenced by my fear or trepidation around the 9th step. Because the good news is, and I tell guys that I'm not going to make you do anything. I got no authority in AA. So don't be afraid to put something down that you're afraid that I'll see, because that's going to be your call. It's our call. We're volunteers in AA. So dude, don't hold yourself back, right? It's interesting that in A Vision for You, there's that conversation about that first meeting with Bill and Dr. Bob, right? And as it describes part of that in A Vision for You, Dr. Bob's buying in, right? He's getting this identification in a way that he didn't anticipate. This 15-minute conversation is turning into, you know, a few hours. But at one point, he pushes back and says, but he didn't want to let the people know. He didn't want to risk his career and his family's well-being and his financial future by going and standing in front of his alcoholism in front of people. And as much as he's buying into everything Bill's saying, he said, I'll do anything but that. And that, of course, is when just a little bit later he went on that ill-fated trip to Atlantic City on the medical conference and went on his last debauch, right? He went on the bender of all benders and came back, right? And Bill takes him in. He's got to do that medical procedure after being hung over, and Bill gave him a goofball and a beer. Now, not many of us sponsors gave us our last goofball. We've been called a goofball, but not given one. But I think the person most grateful for that was the patient, because he wanted Bob to have a steady hand in this proctology exam he was given. So he said, I'll do anything, he said, but that. And what I have to be careful about is in AA is the anything but that's that I get out there, because that is what's going to get me. That's what I'm going to trip over. Chris read the line in there that says, reminding ourselves we're willing to go to any length. And what we're remembering, what we're being reminded of, is all the way back in how it works. It said, if you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And a lot of us have decided we want what we think people in AA have, whether that is physical sobriety or whether that's the smiles and stuff we begin to see from people. But it's that going to any length part that we kind of trip over. I know a guy that when he is going through the book with somebody and they get to that, you know, they get to that statement and he poses it as a question. Have you decided you want what we have? Are you willing to go to any length to get it? Are you ready to take certain steps? And he says, let's sign and date this. And he says, because I'm going to have to remind you of this later. We're going to get over here and you're going to balk. I'm going, no, remember here on Tuesday the 23rd, you said, I'm all in. You know, I was sponsoring a guy one time, and when I started sponsoring him, he lived in a gated community. He had a wife and young son. He was driving a Porsche. And after a year of my sponsorship, he had lost the house, he had lost the family, he had been to jail, and he was living in the Porsche. And that's what good sponsorship will do for you. And he went to jail yet again, and he got out and he called me. And he said, Steve, I'm ready, man. He said, it's not about the wife, it's not about the family. He says, I'm ready, I'll do anything. And I said, all right. And I said, come on over. And he went, right now? I hung up on him, too. Right now? I'll do anything but that. And boy, these immense things look like, you know, whoa, this could not possibly be a good idea. And we sometimes, I hear people say that there's nothing in AA that will hurt you. And I will tell you that sometimes it hurts. There's nothing AA's asked me to do that's not in my best interest. You know, sometimes when you go to the doctor and they're gonna, you know, if you go to the dentist and they're gonna pull some teeth, they're gonna numb you first. When they give me the numbing shot, they go, this is gonna hurt a little bit. We gotta hurt you a little bit to get to the big problem. And so we can really address what's going on. When I'm making that list, as Chris also said, that my list hasn't been limited to the people that were on that four-step inventory, because I hurt some people I had absolutely no resentment against. Some of the people I hurt the most were the people most compliant with me, that were most accommodating to me. But the eighth step in the 12 and 12 says, what do we mean by harms? And it says, in a practical way, we could define this as instincts in collision with others that cause spiritual, mental, physical, or emotional harm. Now, it's not lost on me that what I talked about earlier today in the 12th step is talking about my relationships with people, and specifically in that particular case, a romantic relationship. But that I will want to have relationship with you in the areas of physical, mental, spiritual, and emotional. So that's also the areas in which I am most likely to hurt people. Because that is how ultimately we all relate to each other in one or more of those ways. And I had given no thought to how I might have hurt people spiritually, mentally, or emotionally. You heard me mention that I totaled 6 automobiles. I think I mentioned that here last night. And had these multiple DUIs, at 34 years old was the last DUI that I got that got me to treatment a year later. But I was sitting in front of a lawyer that afternoon after getting that last DUI, and he said, Steve, you think you got a problem with alcohol? I said, pal, what I think I got's a legal problem. I wish you would touch. And I said, that's why my mama wrote you the check. Right? So when I got sober, and when I get to this part, my mind, I owe my mama the money for that check and others. But I had, when my daughter was 18 years old, maybe 19, she totaled her car out. Drunk. Now, I called my mom the next day and I said, Mom, Abby, wrecked her car last night. And my mother said, oh, I hope she's okay. You know, is everybody okay? I said, yeah, she's fine, Mom. I said, but the reason I'm calling you, this was 13 years after I got sober. I said, the reason I'm calling you is because I know we talked about that when I did that and I made amends. I says, but I want you to know today, I know how it felt. See, I paid the money, but I know what I did to people sometimes, but I don't always know what it did to them. I don't know the mental and emotional and spiritual harm that happened. And so it gave me another way to examine and explore these things. And it happens when it says in here that this is the beginning of one of those other lifetime things we go through. I think it means, number one, I'm always going to have a new amends to make somewhere down the line, and that'll fall in the 10th step maybe, where I don't care what number we put in front of it when we do it. But also, I've made amends to the same person for the same event, but for different reasons more than once, as my understanding of that group. And I realized how it impacted them in ways that I had not considered. I hadn't ignored it, I just didn't see it. And I think Chris said that awareness grows over time. So that's been critical. It says when we start on this, it says that in the moment, we're trying to put our lives in order. But our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and those about us. So on the one hand, I'm trying to clean stuff up. But if you look at everything we're doing in the steps, the end game is for me to be freer of me so I can be of some use to you, so I can serve God and my fellows. And I don't seem to be able to do that when those things are standing between me and you. So this is where this eighth and ninth step in, is where I'm really kind of taking care of that last piece of business about me. I've done that self-examination. I have said I'm willing to change. And part of the demonstration of that willingness is to go out and try to set right to the extent that I can the harm I have done. To stand in front of it. And then what can I do to make it better? But I don't want to let my fear of going and standing in front of you stop me from putting you on my list. And I will tell a couple of the men's stories and then give it back to Chris for him to talk about the ninth step a little bit too. But the couple of examples I have about that is that when I got sober, I'm a compulsive gambler as well. And they say gambling's really not my problem, but if you do it as poorly as I do it, it becomes a financial problem. I'm pretty sure if I were winning, nobody would have been complaining. But it also made me a liar, a cheat, and a thief. So gambling, I don't have any position on gambling, but just what it did to me and how I hurt others with that. And sober, I went on a gambling binge at 6 months sober, and I was out in Las Vegas on a work thing. And had to borrow a bunch of money to try to cover up this debt that I had run up at the casinos. And I came back and told the little group I was a part of, told my sponsor, but I wasn't telling Connie yet. I wasn't that sober. And I asked Frank, I did ask him, do I have to tell Connie? And he said, that'll be up to you, Steve. He says, I think that these steps, I said, let's look and see what it says. And we looked and we talked about it, and I said, thanks, I think I'll wait. And then I moved to Richmond, Virginia at a year sober. I got a new sponsor over there. Slate's clean. He doesn't know about that. You don't want to bog them down with old information. And it's now a year and a half later since I've moved, and I'm loving being in AA. But this little pebble's turning into a boulder, you know. And I just couldn't shake it. And then finally I came into some money. My brother, I worked in a family business. I'm getting this bonus that Connie doesn't know about. And so I'm going to be able to pay this debt off. I'd had to get a post office box. It's before electronic banking, obviously. I'm renewing this 90-day note. I'm just doing all the kind of stuff we do to manage that, you know, everything that comes with that. So finally, I tell my sponsor, I sit down with him, and I said, Joe, here's the deal. I said, this is what I did, you know, longer story, but I said, now I've got this money, I'm going to pay it off. And I said, I had signed actually a contract with Connie. She had written a thing out that if I gambled again, she was going to leave me. That, you know, and that's back when we thought signing a contract might mean something. And, you know, that's a solemn oath, by the way. And I laid it out, and I said, well, you know, I haven't gambled in this year and a half, and she doesn't deserve to be hit with that. And I was putting into the accepting to do so would injure them or others category. And I was very eloquent in my defense of this and my concern for her. And I got done, and I said, what do you think? And he said, Steve, I think you're chicken shit. He said, I believe you believe everything you said. He said, in fact, I believe it's true. You don't want to hurt her. He says, but I think more than that, you're afraid to stand in front of the consequences of the truth. And he said, nay, hey, we don't quit making mistakes. We start standing in front of the mistakes we made. He says, I don't know whether she would leave you over that or not. He said, He said, you're going to do what you're going to do. But again, we just looked at what it said, and I went home and told her, and it was difficult, but we're still together. I'll tell you, she has, she's got all the spiritual maturity in our family, I'll tell you. But I also told you, and this is where I want to show you the difference in the eighth and ninth step and why I think it's important to really do that eighth step, to not only make the list, but to acquire through prayer the willingness, because the freedom's in the willingness. The freedom is when I'm no longer pushing back. I'll do it. I'm afraid, but I'll do it. And I told you about those infidelities that were in my marriage before before I got sober. And my sponsor, Frank, and I went through that in my inventory, the first one I did, and we talked about it, and with prayer and his guidance, and not landing there easily, and not to protect myself, but that fell into the category we believed, we determined, would do more harm than good, would be hurtful to her, and so not to share it. But it was on my list. I was willing to do it. And we talked about what that would look like. We talked in our book, gives us some direction about that type of an amends, which you don't do. What you do, you don't name other people, you don't bring other people into that. So we had this whole thing. 4 years later, Connie and I are sitting down having a conversation. It wasn't even an unpleasant conversation. And for the first time ever, she asked me, almost out of the blue, she says, have you ever been unfaithful in our marriage? And I'm telling you, I wasn't going to be able to pull, you know, I might be capable of the lie, just what, no, you know, I wasn't going to be able to pull it off. My voice is going to go up 3 octaves. But honestly, intuitively, in that moment, I knew that the truth was called for. And see what I'm grateful, and we had that conversation. And again, all the credit to her for navigating through that, because it hurt. It hurt, but she has never beat me back over the head with that. But the point for tonight's conversation was that having done that eighth step, having explored how that conversation might go, how my side of that conversation might go, was critically important. If I just said, no, I'm never going to deal with that, then in that moment, I wouldn't have known how to handle it. I wouldn't have known what to do. Maybe I would have done it, but done it more clumsily than I did it. Maybe I wouldn't have done it at all. What I know is it was the thing to do in that moment. And so that's why I think this eighth step is critical, to do that, whether even in the moment, as Chris said, whether right now, that might be one of those I say I'm not ready to make yet, or it's not time to make it. That I want to step back from. So, it says in here, some of us owe money, right? Check. Some of us have legal problems, check. Some of us have domestic problems, check. These are other areas of my life that I want to examine to see where there might be an amends that is owed. Then determine if it should be made now, or if that, you know, it says in the 12 and 12 that the qualities someone needs to make an amends is a good judgment, a careful sense of timing, courage, and prudence. These are the qualities required. And what I would share with you is that when I'm the one in the barrel, I don't have those qualities. So I need those qualities. So I go to a sponsor who has those qualities. So that good judgment's probably not mine. Particularly in the moment, that careful sense of timing, that courage, that prudence. I need to get that, so I ask God for power I don't have to do something I can't do. I talk to a sponsor and trusted confidants for their input and their experience about what they have done. And probably no step have I benefited more from the direction and shared experience of a sponsor than the ninth step. So, Chris. Thanks.
So another thing to watch out for with the eighth and especially the ninth step is this. If you want to find somebody who'll co-sign you as far as not having to do that, this amends, you'll find a lot of them in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if you look for that, you will find people who will say, yeah, I don't make those kind of amends either. You know, I don't think you need to do that. You'll find those people. The real freedom, though, is in the actual making of the amends, the willingness in the making of the amends. So when you're looking for a sponsor or a spiritual advisor to give you guidance on specific amends, I recommend that you find someone with experience with these amends. And it's not 100% of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous have experience with this stuff. So just some amends stories of mine. How to approach the man we hated. Okay, I had an experience with this guy. I was about eight years sober, and I had an experience with this guy, and he was an Alcoholics Anonymous member. And he came at me pretty hard. There were some confidence that were broken. There was some stuff that he shared really was inappropriate to share, and a number of other things. Now, this person is in my fellowship, right? He's in my core group, and I go ballistic. I come out of my aggression comes out of retirement for this, okay? And I'm talking to people about it, and I'm my sponsees, and there's like a team of people for all this crap. It was a monster nightmare, and one of the guys that I was sponsoring at that time said, they all had a lot of respect and they cared for me a lot, but this one guy told me the truth, and it was one of my sponsees. He said, "Chris, you're gonna need to set this right," because he had gone out and done a million amends. He's looking at me. You're gonna need to make amends to him, and I'm like, if I could put the math together, 99% of the problems were this guy just coming at me. Okay, I don't know where it even came from. But there was 1% of me, like talking bad about him, talking about the situation, getting people to take my side. And I was mad when this guy told me this, right? I was mad when he told me that I was going to need to set this right. But it haunted me. Became willing. Picked up the telephone, set an appointment, went and met this guy. And, you could argue that 99% of the blame was his. But that's not what I'm supposed to do in this step. Putting the wrongs that he has done aside, I resolutely take the bit in my teeth and go to him expressing my former ill feeling. And I did that, and it was not an easy amends. I really tried to do my job, and I probably would do a better job today, but I did a good enough job. And after the amends, I felt like washing my mouth out with gasoline for doing it. But I want to tell you what happened. From that moment forth, there was no power in what this guy had said or done. I was free of it. It didn't matter. There was a release that was incredible for doing this. There was a release. And once more I was shown that I was wrong and AA was right. I knew this amends would go wrong and this is not the right thing to do. And once more, Alcoholics Anonymous showed me these spiritual principles work. And to this day, listen, we're not best friends. But I did an event with him up in Boston not long ago, and we're okay. We'll have coffee together, and all that stuff is water over the dam. Most alcoholics owe money, all right. I wasn't really bad with money. I've sponsored people who come in like a million in debt. I was more of a small time operator, but there was one amends that I needed to do, and it had to do with some crazy days in Florida. I lived in Florida for about 5 years. I went down there to go to a university. A friend of mine called me up one day and said, oh, man, this is a great university. There's a bar in every building, and this is where all the drugs come through. You know, we get them cut rate. And I'm like, the next day I got an application in the mail. You know, I didn't even know what the school taught. And I'm on my way down there. And I really applied myself the 5 years I was there, and I came away with a solid 6 credits. Over those 5 years, solid. I'm very, very proud of that. Now what happened was, it was some of the worst years of my life because it was just unchained, Chris, right? And I remember we were renting a house. Me, a Quaalude dealer, and another alcoholic on unemployment, and we were renting this house together, and we got thrown out because we were having loud parties till like 4 in the morning, and. This one time, the landlord calls up and says, this time you guys are really going to have to go. And we got really drunk, and we had a house trashing party. Has there anybody ever had a house trashing party? It's when you kick in every wallboard, you break every window. Well, I even got up on the roof and kicked a chimney off the house. Any chimney off the house kickers here? Welcome. You know, it was one of those cheap Florida chimneys.
That's a specialty.
And we took all the doors off and made a bonfire in the backyard. I mean, we made this place permanently uninhabitable. And then we left like 3 weeks early. So this, I hadn't even thought about this like until I got sober. And then it comes into my consciousness that, you know, I got to take some care of some stuff in Florida. And then I start to get letters from Florida. What had happened was I'd gotten a DUI. I'd blown off the court date. There was community service I was supposed to do. All these ambulance bills, because I was one of those guys that, you know, ended up in the ambulance every once in a while for one reason or another. There was all kinds of like real legal troubles, and it was really piling up on me down there. And I did what some of us do. I thought, you know, I think Mom needs some help around the house back up in New Jersey. You know, I think I'll help her out, and I'll go up there and paint the house. And I went up there and moved in for 8 years. And I started to get this mail because the computers start to come online, right? So I have to take care of all this stuff, and I spent a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of effort setting these things right. And you know, sometimes when it's like it's criminal, you know you got an extra motivation to get it over with and get past it and get the paper off your back. But there were just a number of those amends. I told you about, you know, I wasn't a big thief or anything, and I wasn't the kind of guy who'd borrow a lot of money, and I didn't have any credit cards, you know, but the money that I owed, I ended up paying back. The domestic trouble, my wife that followed me down to Florida, and within a year and a half was out of there. You know what I mean? We got married, and then we got divorced, I think, in about a 12-month period of time. She took my daughter, she took my dog, and she took my car, and never came back. And so for the longest time, I had a huge resentment about her. You know, I mean, you know, I can remember sitting at the bar with a triple bourbon. You know, she left me when I needed her the most. Those women, you know, and if you would have asked me what my thoughts about women were the day I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have said this: you can't trust them. They're all crazy, and they're need bags. I mean, I would have had this whole list, and I would have painted all you women with that same brush, right? Because that was my experience. I start doing these inventories, and I start to see that they'd have been crazy to stay with me, and really the problem in the whole situation was toxic proximity to me. is what really caused all the problems in these relationships. You can't act like I did and have everything work out fine. And so you know, I went out to Colorado. I made amends to my ex-wife. There was just a whole bunch of them, and there's a continuing process to these amends. I want to share just a couple of current ones, at least one current one, and then I'll hand it back to Steve. I had this buddy from about 2000 to about 2010. We were running buddies in Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, we were road dogs together. Every crazy thing that I got involved with, I would bring this guy along. We were tight. It was like family. And you'll have these type of friendships in Alcoholics Anonymous. They feel closer to you sometimes than family, some of these friendships. And all of a sudden, there's some distance that starts to happen. All of a sudden, he's not returning my phone calls. Okay? He's real nice to me, you know, when I see him at a meeting or something, it doesn't feel like there's anything wrong, but there's a distance. We're not getting together anymore. We're not doing holidays together like we used to. We're not running around. And, you know, and this goes on about 5-6 years, maybe longer, maybe 7 or 8 years. And I feel a loss of it. It was just one of those friendships. I feel a loss. We were really close. You know what I mean? I feel a loss. And I'm putting a 10 step together this one time. And I get this intuitive thought. And the intuitive thought is this: make an appointment and make an amends. I wasn't conscious of any amends that needed to be made. I really wasn't. But this separation was, it felt wrong to me. So I did that. He met me at a Dunkin' Donuts and we sat down. And, you know, I started off by basically saying, you know, I just don't feel like, you know, things are going real well with us. And I want to ask you, and I want you to be honest with me, you know, is there anything you need to talk about me with? Is there any harms that I've caused? Because I'm really not aware of any. And he said, yeah, there's a harm. He said the Tuesday night meeting, you took it over with a whole new bunch of people. And I'm like, what are you talking about? What had happened is the Tuesday night Burnsville meeting had shrunk. You know, we'd moved away and it had gotten really small, and it was him and two or three people. And a new group of people moved in to the meeting. They saw that this is a great place to meet. There's really nobody showing up there anymore. They went and they talked to the minister of the church, saying that meeting's over. We'd like to move our meeting. They're getting kicked out, you know, not too far away, and they want to move their meeting into this church. And the minister said, fine. So one day, all of a sudden, they show up. And I'm like, I didn't have anything to do with that. And he goes, what? I go, that wasn't me. I wasn't going to either one of those meetings. So it was a misunderstanding that had separated this really tight friendship for like 8 years. So there's something to be said about the principle, seeing in the principle of this step, being current with people. You know, my spiritual lineage, they would do this. Every once in a while, they would just sit with somebody and make sure that they're current. You know, is there anything that we need to talk about? And we're back friends now. You know what I mean? We talk to each other. It's like nothing ever happened. It was a misunderstanding. You know, it's some places, I'm sober a long time now, and yet I still have this capacity to not look under certain rocks. And one of the things that I needed to do for a long, long time was to sit with my wife, Andrea, and get really current with her and put together a list of ways I've fallen short and sit with her and talk with her about it. And the crazy thing is I didn't think I needed to do that, you know, because we're married and we talk all the time and we're together, we sleep in the same bed. You know, do I really need to do that? And I found out by doing it, yes, I really needed to do it. You know, because things really, really changed in a positive way after that. I was as honest as I possibly could be about the ways that I was falling short in the time that we were married. And she really appreciated it. You know, so this immense thing, it's a way of life. You know, I want to see it as an exercise, that where I'll do the exercise, or, you know, I'll muscle through it, you know, I'll be done, and everything will be fine, and I'll move on. But I found that the way I really need to live is I need to be responsible for my behavior. I need to be responsible for it. And I don't want things to go unaddressed. I don't want the ways I've fallen short that could have harmed you, I don't want that to go unaddressed. And the thing I've gotten back from these amends is an enormous amount of power, an enormous amount of spiritual power, and an enormous amount of freedom, an enormous amount of spiritual freedom. I really do feel like I can go any place on this earth at any time without having to worry about anything. And I feel that I've got a renewed ability to do a lot of these things. And I know it comes from the spiritual work. It does not come from me just trying to fix things myself. It comes from actually taking the action and then getting the results back. Every single action step in this book has a series of unbelievable promises. Are these extravagant promises? Yes! They are! For somebody like me, you know? And so, you know, I'm really grateful to be here tonight. I'll pass it back to you.
Thanks, Chris. You know, that last thing you were talking about in making that amends to Andrea, I was at an event like this in New York 3 years ago, a men's retreat, and we were having this eighth and ninth step discussion, and I was talking about the fact, and my wife had shared with me over the years that there were times, and I guess it's maybe, I think the term today most often used as gaslighting, right? But that I was gaslighting her long before I knew what it meant, basically to protect myself. But I would convince her that what she saw that was and thought and heard that was absolutely true wasn't accurate. And I would spin it in such a way to make her doubt herself. I tell you, when my daughter was really young, when my daughter was like three, you know, I would come in from work. First thing I would do was go upstairs and smoke a joint and have a drink. And then I would come back down where she was and maybe, you know, it was about bedtime for her then at that age. And she would say, and my wife and I didn't smoke at that time, and she would say, "Daddy, you smell like smoke." And I would go, "No, I don't." and not even thinking that I'm already, like, it's like telling her that a cow is a horse. That at 3 years old, I'm telling her, don't trust your instincts. Don't trust yourself. And I'm now doing that with my wife when she was an adult. And we'd had that conversation. I mean, she told me about it, and I kind of nodded like I got it. But I'm out having this conversation and began to talk to these men about it. And I can't tell you how many came up later and talked about having a similar experience doing that. It just seems to be kind of not an uncommon thing. And And I realized I had acknowledged it, but I had never really owned it with my wife. And I got home that Sunday afternoon, and I went back to our bedroom. She was in the bedroom, and I said, I need to talk to you. And we had that conversation. I said, I get it, man. And when she said, it was maybe one of the most satisfying experiences, one of the most intimate conversations we've had. And but I blow by those opportunities all the time, sometimes not even purposely, just not aware, spiritually asleep. This is, you know, Chris talked about that at the end of that chapter, after, you know, just before the promises, there's a line that we hear quoted, or a version of it quoted, in a lot of AA meetings. Line here says, as God's people, we stand on our own feet. We don't crawl before anyone. Well, we sit in meetings and claim that independence, right? As God's people, we don't crawl before anyone. But the preceding sentence doesn't get nearly as much press. The preceding sentence says, we are kind, considerate, tactful, and humble without being servile or scrapy. In other words, when I go make these amends, even to the guy that I hate, even to the guy that he's 99% and I'm 1%, that I want to take an attitude of kindness and courtesy and humility and consideration into that. Now, I'm not servile or scraping. I don't have to hang my head. I don't have to shuffle my feet. But it's not in some pound my chest way. It is just, how can I just go take this head on, straight on, and do this? It's not lost on me that it's in this part of the book, in the eighth and ninth step, where another line that we reference all the time is plucked from, but sometimes I don't put it into context of where it is in the steps. And it says, the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. This is where this is the first time in my recovery, that beyond a sponsor, I'm going out in front of other people. This is when we're taking what has been this inside baseball, right? We're playing at the meetings all week, you know. Can't wait to get to a meeting to tell you about me. But now I'm going outside the room. Now I'm going out and to those people who won't necessarily understand, who aren't gathered to help pat me on the back and say, you're a winner and keep coming back, you know. Now I'm going and I'm going to stand in front of this stuff. And so the spiritual life's not a theory. We have to live it. That faith without works is dead. And that's where we go with this there. I'm going to use the next 10 minutes that we've got to talk about the 10th step. And then Chris will pick the 10th step up in the morning when we start, so we can try to touch all the bases. But I will tell you, this is again my feeling, and I think it's steps 9, 10, 11, and 12, as I look at them now, actually start simultaneously. Now they almost can't do that exactly, because particularly when we're going through the steps and we're trying to, you know, navigate with a sponsor through there. But this says, after the promises, after those extravagant promises that Chris talked about, and with the last line being, they will always materialize if we work for them, this thought brings us to step 10. The thought being that this will materialize if I work for them, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes. As we go along, we vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. So as I'm going through this, as I'm getting started with my ninth step, I want to clean up any new mistakes. You know, if I'm at home and I'm cleaning up a big mess in the den and I kick over an ashtray or a glass of tea while I'm cleaning up the big mess, I don't go, well, I'll get to that in a few months. No, I clean it up as I go along. And so, because I can make a new mistake on the way home from my first amends, you know, that will require, in fact, sometimes my first amends is in itself a mistake that needs some cleaning up. But so we start this as we commence cleaning up the past. And now it tells me that this is the continue step, right? And there's always, we can, you know, my sponsor today, Don M. in Louisville, Don's a guy who comes from his sponsorship lineage. That Don were here, he would tell you that it is his belief and his experience that you work the first 9 steps once, and then you live in steps 10, 11, and 12. But to live in steps 10, 11, and 12, you have to be working the first 9 steps. So it is a distinction without a difference to me. I don't get caught up in it. When you hear somebody say in a meeting that, as you know, that they're doing another 4th step, well, I don't care if it's a 4th step or a 10th step. Again, I don't care what number is in front of the action I'm taking if I'm taking the right action. I want to have an experience. I'm not a numerologist, right? I'm looking for a spiritual experience. And so I don't get too hung up on that stuff, but I do know that I'm continuing to take personal inventory. And it says that now that I have taken these first 9 steps, or I'm engaged, I've taken the first 8 and I'm engaged in this 9th step and beginning this 10th step, as Chris says, I am current as I can be. Well, now what's my function? Now what am I supposed to do? Well, my next function, it says, is to grow in understanding and effective. I've been getting rid of all of that stuff that's in my way to now. Let me grow in understanding and effectiveness. And love and tolerance of others is my code. So now I've got a call to action, I've got a function, and I've got a code to live by. Love and tolerance of others. And what I've discovered, for me anyway, is that those are inextricably tied together. This growing in understanding and effectiveness and love and tolerance. I cannot be very understanding and effective if I'm not loving and tolerant. And if I'm not loving and tolerant, I can't be very effective in understanding. They seem to be interdependent upon one another. And this tolerance has taken a change for me on what that means. There's a guy who gets over now, in fact, a guy named Steve A. He passed away this last week. But Steve had given me this little card years ago that had a description or definition of tolerance that I had not seen before. And I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but because I tend to view tolerance as I'll tolerate you, right? I'll sit here and just know what a jackass you are, but I won't say it out loud, and we'll just sit here. But this described tolerance as a generosity and bigness of spirit, allowing others their particular point of view and peculiarities. Now, my favorite word there is the peculiarities. Yeah. He's not a jackass. He's peculiar. It's a gentler word. He's just peculiar. I'm pretty peculiar. And this love and tolerance is then begins not me having that harsh judgment I tend to have. I still have to assess things. Cliff Rhodes said years ago, he said, we say in AA that we don't judge people. He said, we judge, but we don't condemn. We make assessments, but we don't shoot our wounded. We don't kick you out of the club. If you can't screw up in AA, where can you screw up? You know, if I can't make a mistake here and try to learn and grow by that mistake, then I'm out of places to go. We already said it was the last house on the block. So this 10th step has me arrive here, and then it says, and I alluded to it either earlier today or yesterday, it talks about the fact that by now, so arriving at this place, I will be sane as it pertains to alcohol. And so now this is where typically in my experience is that I'm not resisting a drink. Because when I first got to AA, I don't know about you guys, I thought we were going to spend a lot of time not drinking in AA. I thought not drinking was an actual activity in Alcoholics Anonymous. We'll just get together and not drink. You know, would you look at him not drink over there? Look at the technique on that guy. And he reached for it and pulled back. And that's what we do. We'd get together and talk each other out of a drink. And I'd be resisting this drink. And I'm going to do it because I'm in. I know I need to not drink. But it's going to be a pretty pitiful life. It's going to be all about where I can't go, what I can't do, who I can't hang out with. You know, got to say, hey, Steve, man, we're going to go on a ball game, going to go to the game on Sunday. You want to go? And I go, boy, I would love to go, but I am busy on Sunday. I will be home not drinking. And you know, and somebody said, don't drink even if your ass falls off, right? So I'll be home not drinking, guarding my ass. The thing is, I believe that because there is a little bit of not drinking early on in AA. You know, a day at a time, what a pitiful, you know, call to action that sounded like. Can you just not drink today? Can you gut it out? And so we don't drink a day at a time, and that's kind of the way it starts for some of us. But what happens over time is that becomes, I live a day at a time. I get to live in this day. I'm not fighting something off. And it says the problem will have been removed with no thought or action on our part. As I said, that thought or action is through the steps trying to connect to this power. Then it says, and we get the reminder that we all need, you know, hey, it's a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of the spiritual condition. And my sponsor would make a distinction between my spiritual condition and my work, my maintenance on it. You know, I can be working on the car. I might not be very good at it. It might not be in good running condition. But if I'm working on the car, I probably can't get into any trouble doing anything else. So if I am working on that spiritual condition through prayer, meditation, going to meetings, being sponsored, sponsoring people, working with others, taking a service commitment, being in the third legacy, if I've got some combination of those things going on, I might be in good stead to get through this day without it feeling like I'm not drinking. Because 32 years later, AA would be a tough place to do time. It'd be a tough place just to try to not drink. But man, those of us, most of the people here been around a while, you know that that's not why we're here. That's not the experience we're having. We're in this 10th step where the problem has been removed in a 24-hour cycle contingent upon the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And it says, every day is a day where I must carry the vision of God's will into all my activities. That selfish self-centeredness, Chris even talked about it earlier today, where I am viewing everything through the prism of self. How does this affect me? Now it says I'm looking through God's eyes. Every day is a day on the vision of God's will for me. Not what should I do here, what would God have me do? And that sounds, that's a big, you know, too big for me. I mean, I'm not getting direct messages from God, but I tell you how I handled that in AA. I took an inventory, a non-AA inventory one time. I mean, the AA guy wrote it, but it wasn't, you know, we stay sober about 10 years, we all got a book in us, right, that improves on the one that we use day to day. And this guy had written, and the first page on this inventory where I was in the state says, what do you think about your marriage? And I wrote some stuff down, you know, honestly, wrote it down. Turned the page, and next page went, no, really, what do you think about it? And you know, there was some more stuff, because it made me think about it in a different way. And then I turned the page and said, what would God think about your marriage? Well, when I'm looking for direction from God, and we'll move into that 11th step as well, right? But when I'm trying to figure out what to do, when I'm trying to use every day as a day when I must carry the vision of God's will, what's God's will for me, into all my activities, kind of big for me to try to figure out. But what I have decided is that God is not handicapped by my human frailty. So God would not do or not do anything because he's afraid or she's afraid. God would not do or not do anything out of lust, out of greed, out of fear, out of any of those seven deadly sins, out of those things that hold me bondage. God is not bound by those things like I am. So God wouldn't, you know, so what would I do if I weren't limited by those human qualities? And it gives me a better picture. And it says that I will take, and we'll talk about it in the 12th step tomorrow, right? Practicing these principles in all our affairs. The last thing I'll say, I got 2 minutes. You know, I'll be brief and I'll end with this. The, that it says, because this has always been an important one for me in the 10th step, right after that spiritual axiom thing that I talked about earlier today. But it says, what about justifiable anger? You know, isn't there some justifiable anger? And the book doesn't say that there's not some things that justify anger that wouldn't be justified. It just says that I should leave it to those more equipped to handle it. And that's the same advice you give me about alcohol. I can take a drink. It's legal. I'm grown. I mean, but you guys have said I probably should leave alcohol to those better equipped to handle it. And that for me, anger is poison. I got a right to be angry, but I don't have to be. And it also says that no people are probably worse at identifying and discerning between justifiable and unjustifiable anger. So I'm also not good at that. And so that's where, you know, this anger and it's just like I was saying earlier today in that inventory, the resentment inventory, I keep wanting to adjudicate the facts. I keep wanting to prosecute the case rather than be free of the anger. And today, the choice I've made is I prefer to be free of the anger rather than be right. We all say it flippantly a lot. You want to be right and you want to be happy. And of course, most of us think being right would make me happy. And really, it's not even that. A guy told me, he said, Steve, he says, he says, I have a problem, you know, having to be right all the time. I said, I don't believe you, man. He said, yeah. He said, I just have to be right. And I said, no. I said, I just don't think that's the problem. I said, because you're right the moment you're right. You're right if you're right. So it's not your need to be right that's your problem. It's the need for everybody else to know you're right that's your problem. So see, if I'm right, I'm right. But I need you to know I'm right. I need to sway the jury. I need you to acknowledge, hopefully, in a large enough crowd of people, perhaps media, that I'm right. So this 10th step gives me even more personal freedom from self, than I've had. 8:45, I hit it on the button. We're done. Thank you.